Our reading from the Lord's Word this morning is from Genesis 1. We're going to read from verse 26 to Genesis 2, verse 3. You can find that on page 2 of the Pew Bible. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Then God said, "I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food." And it was so. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed and all the vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all this work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done.
Friends, you might want to keep your Bible or your phone open at that point. The point of Genesis, that'll be great as we dive in here. You know, there's a story told of a Russian rabbi wandering through Russia at night as the snow started to fall and it was turning into a storm. And he was kind of lost in his thoughts and his musings as he wandered around until he was brought to an abrupt halt by a voice out of the darkness that said, "Who are you? What are you doing here?" And he stopped and looked up and said, Excuse me, what did you say? "Who are you and what are you doing here?" This was a voice of a young Russian soldier with his machine gun at a military outpost. And the rabbi said, "How much do they pay you? What does that have to do with anything? Who are you and what are you doing here?" And the rabbi said, "Because I'll pay you twice as much as what they're paying you now if you would just ask me those questions every day. Who are you? And what are you doing here?" These questions grab a mind and demand answers. And they're given voice in stories which shape generations. Take Man of Steel, for example. Later, Superman. You know that this story, the story of Superman, has been shaping minds for 8 decades now. 80 years this story has been told and retold. And of course, I know the story, but I couldn't help steal myself away to go see the Man of Steel. Clark Kent knows in all of the story that he is different. He has known it all of his life. It's just that no one can give him an answer as to why he's different or why he's on earth. And he stumbles around trying to work that out. Can't work it out until he chances upon a 3D holographic consciousness of his father who explains everything to him. And not just simply who he is, but why he's on earth. The only question that is not answered in this movie is why there are no red underpants on the outside. But I think that's the stuff for the sequel, don't you? Superman searches for his undies. With his origins sorted out, Kent's present and future make sense. Now, I have to fess up, I never tire of this story. I've read all the comics and I've seen everything from the days of the black and white George Reeves through all of the Supermen, and I just enjoy the story, particularly as technology allows movie producers to get close to what the comics were trying to say to us when the original guys drew it. It's just very spectacular. I love it. Frederick Buchner has said that every age produces stories like this that captivate us. There is something inside of us that believes or wants to believe that the world as we know it is not the whole story. We long for the re-enchantment of reality. These stories don't simply demand that another world exists. A common feature to all these stories is that life and the other world is not that far away. You walk into a wardrobe and you feel the air begin to chill and a lamppost tells you you're now in Narnia. Or you walk down a train station to platform 9 1/4 and step into a world where boys and girls become something they ordinarily are not. And these stories deeply touch us, and the ones that endure are the ones that deeply touch us. Tolkien said it's the mark of a good fairy story on the higher or more complex kind that no matter how wild the events or however fantastic or terrible the adventures, it can give to a child or a man who hears it. When the turn comes, a catch of breath, a beat and lifting of the heart, near to or indeed accompanied by tears as keen as that given by any form of literary art. These stories are not just about the transformation of the world around us. The central characters are transformed. Frogs become princes, ugly ducklings become swans, wooden marionettes become real little boys. And with each story, a little more light is thrown on our questions. Who are you? And what are you doing here? When the stories are real stories, then the sense of who we are intensifies. So I remember as a little boy, my grandmother telling stories about her childhood and the family and all that kind of thing. And she said, you know, Teeny Weeny Grandpa, and he was called Teeny Weeny Grandpa because he was teeny weeny. I was about 9 or 10 and I was taller than him. He was hunched over and called Teeny Weeny. He was my great-grandfather, my grandmother's father. Teeny Weeny Grandfather. His surname is Ferdinand. And you go, that's a big name in another country. It's a big name in Spain. Teeny Weeny Grandpa was a prince who left Spain and came to Australia to get away from stuff in Spain. Changes things a little bit for a little boy. Changed my brother and I's view of things, so much so that my brother went to school not long after that and explained to the whole class that he was a Spanish prince and they ought to come to order. Today we begin to explore a new series aimed at answering these questions. Who are you? And what are you doing here? The series we're looking at is called His Story, Our Story. And we're going to explore the story of humanity as it's recorded in the pages of the Bible. We want to look at the Bible because it stands out from all the other accounts of creation. And we begin in the very first pages of the Bible in Genesis, where your Bible is open, and we begin with my friend here, Adam. This is Adam, drawn by one of our young adults. This is fantastic. This is a free-form hand drawing. This is Adam, and we're going to use a word with each personality we introduce. So we're looking at people like Adam and Abraham and David and Moses and so on. And Adam's word is the word potential. So this is Adam, and his word is potential. So if I say to you, Adam, you'll say potential. So Adam, potential. This is Adam. Very good. We're looking at Adam and potential today. But before we get into it a little more, I need to clear the ground a little bit. Going into Genesis in the 21st century is like going into a battlefield littered with burnt tanks and planes and jeeps and unexploded hand grenades, landmines. There's rubble everywhere. And it comes because the biblical fundamentalists on one hand have a story, and the scientific materialists also have a story. So the fundamentalists say the 7 days in Genesis are literal, 24 hours, and so creation happened in 24 hours. Now that could have happened. The scientists, on the other hand, say the evidence is way against that, like it didn't happen in 7 literal days. The biblical fundamentalists say, oh, no, it did, and it took place 6,000 years ago. The scientific materialists, on the other hand, roll their eyes and go, the evidence is it's at least 14 billion, count them, billion years old for the carbon dating. It's billions of years old. It's not 6,000, it's billions. And so they come at it this way. Both camps come with lenses that were fashioned by the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. And so they read Genesis literalistically, which is different to reading it literally. I'm going to hopefully make a distinction here. Read it literalistically. A literalistic reading takes the words of Genesis at face value based on what you see through the lens of the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. So, for example, the word day is taken as an exact 24-hour period. And both the fundamentalists and the materialists read all of Genesis 1 and 2, therefore, as a historical, blow-by-blow account of the mechanics of creation. This is exactly how, this is God's blueprint for exactly how it panned out, they say. And the focus on the word day misses just about everything that the writer of Genesis wants us to see. And to see what the writer wants us to see, we need to pay attention to the genre of Genesis 1 and 2 and the historical context in which it was written. Genesis 1 and 2 is a highly stylized piece of literature. It's characterized by intricate structure, rhythm, parallelism, thing called chaimos, repetition, and the lavish use of number symbolism. It's very complex. It's very lavish. Now, I know this is a bit of a headspace. We'll get coffee afterwards. It's fine. The coffee will come to soothe the pulsating things in your head. But it's important to do this to clear the ground so that we will see the value of Genesis 1 and 2. In Genesis 1, let me just take one example of how numbers are used. Multiples of 7 appear in extraordinary ways. Now, at this point, I'm indebted to the work of John Dixon, one of Australia's foremost ancient historians. He had some great things to say on Genesis 1. The multiples of 7 appear in quite extraordinary ways, and for ancient readers who are attuned to observing such things, these convey a really powerful message. So let me show you just one avenue here. In the very first sentences of Genesis 1, the very first sentence, there are 7 Hebrew words. There are more words in English because it takes more words to translate, but in the original text, the Hebrew text, there are 7. Instantly, an ancient reader's mind is galvanized. 7. The second sentence contains 14 Hebrew words. Just reinforces the galvanization. The word earth appears in the chapter 21 times, 3 times 7. The word heaven appears in the chapter 21 times. God, the word God, is mentioned exactly 35 times. The refrains, and it was so, and God saw it was good, occur 7 times each. The whole account is structured around 7 scenes, or 7 days. This is just one thing to talk about the lavish structure of Genesis 1 and 2. This is not a piece of Renaissance or Enlightenment science. It's much grander than that. This is artistry that throughout the whole chapter is stunning. And to ancient readers, it gave a clear, unmistakable word that creation is a work of art where God is sharing his perfection and working in it. Genesis 1 and 2 does communicate truth, but it's not as a scientific blow-by-blow account of history of creation. It's something much more profound than that. Something much more profound. And it's being told, what is being told here will confront perceptions about men and women that people hold dear in the 21st century and will explain to us our origins and who we are and why we are here. So, cleared the ground a little bit. Let's dive a little bit further into this. What Genesis has to say to us is particularly profound when you compare it with other ancient creation accounts. Take Chinese, Japanese, Hindu traditions, for example. These traditions speak to us about how creation emerged, like Lady Gaga did at a concert a few years ago, from an egg. So there's this big egg and it opened up and creation appeared. The Norse and Babylonian accounts tell us that creation is a result of the war between the gods in some kind of heavenly realm. And the world was created out of the body parts of the dead gods. One I particularly like is African, where the story is told of a giant who got sick and vomited, and here we are. That's pretty much it. It might be because I'm Australian and I've seen quite a bit of that over the years. Anyway, not mine. The Bible has a very different account to all of those. God creates everything not out of conflict, no body parts. We're told God creates everything out of no thing. He creates everything out of nothing. He creates with words. He creates without a rival. He creates not as a warrior in battle. He creates as an artist. God is a craftsman, an artisan. And things get really interesting when we look at the place given to men and women in Genesis and compare that to other accounts. Let's just take one account, the Babylonian account. It's just a few centuries older than Genesis, ironically discovered at about the same time Charles Darwin was writing his book on evolution. It was discovered about the same time, and it's only a couple of centuries older than Genesis, which makes it a very good contemporary for us to look at. This Babylonian account tells us that the world was created using the body parts of the defeated head male and female gods. The victorious god, his name is Marduk. He sentences the enemies of his army to servitude, and their role is to collect food and to serve the gods. The defeated gods start to complain. This is not something that gods should do. It's indignant. So they go to Marduk and beg him to make something that is more suited to this slavery. Now, that idea tickles Marduk's fancy, and so we read in what is called the Enuma Elish these words. When Marduk heard the complaints of the gods, he said, "I will establish a savage. Man shall be his name. He shall be charged with the service of the gods, that they may be at ease." And so he takes the blood of one of the defeated gods and makes humanity to set the gods free. Humans are an afterthought in the Babylonian understanding, a necessity, a necessary evil to get the gods off the back of Marduk and to simply be slaves to satiate the needs and the pleasures of the gods. The Bible has a very different understanding of who we are. Listen to the rhythm and structure of Genesis 1 to see what God thinks of us. See, follow, there's a pattern here. First of all, there's a creative command. Look at Genesis chapter 1 and verse 3. And God said, "Let there be light." This is a command. This is command language. "Let there be light." Verse 6, "Let there be an expanse between the waters." Verse 9, "Let the water under the sky." Verse 14, "Let there be lights." Verse 20, "Let the water teem with living creatures." Verse 24, "Let the land produce." These are one command after another. After each command, another part of the pattern appears where there's a report on the command being carried out. So let's go to verse 4. "Let there be light," and there was light. And then we're told God saw the light was good. So the creative, the command has been carried out, and then there's a bit of creative detail added each one. So God saw the light was good, and he separated light from darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And then the final piece in the pattern is this: "And there was morning, evening and morning the first day." That pattern is repeated 6 times. There is a command, a report that the command has been fulfilled, a creative detail added, and a night-day conclusion. And that rhythm goes on and on and on and on and on and on until we get to verse 26, where it says, "Then God said, let us make man in our image." This is not a command, "Let there be man."
This is let us deliberate together. Let us consider. Let us make man in our image. The aim is to grab our attention, to focus our minds, that we might linger because something of significance is taking place here. This is different to all the other acts of creation. Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, he says. And let them rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air. And verse 27, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. Humanity is not an afterthought anywhere in the Bible. Humanity is not a creature who is made to serve the gods. In fact, there's a really interesting piece in verse 29 where it says, then God says, speaking to his image, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. This is yours for food. How different is that to the Babylonian one? Let's create a savage, call him man, and he will get food for us. God says, no. I give you all of this, and this is your food that I give you. Friends, this is a cup over your mouth moment. If we read on, we will not find that there is anything else created. We are the pinnacle. We are the zenith of God's good creation. And as we stand in awe, the Bible challenges much of the thinking in our world. Let's look at some philosophy and science, which tells us in certain schools that we are no more than animals. We have evolved out of the slush and the slime of some backwater swamp and eventually evolved from one creature into another, which developed into some kind of mammal form, and we developed and evolved from that into human beings. Now, I know those of you who've got teenage kids knows there's some kind of evidence for evolution as a child evolves out of the slush and the slime of the swamp called their bedroom. I understand that. But we are not animals. We are not animals. This also challenges certain psychology and certain psychological practices, which tells us that we are captive to certain passions and certain drives. And that finds expression in popular songs. One song called by Bloodhound Gang, their song's called Discovery Channel. You know this in the part, the words are, you and me, baby, we ain't nothing but mammals, let's, and you know the rest of it. Don't sing it. It's been recorded, you re-record it. But you see, that thinking is we are no more than animals. Let's do what they do on the Discovery Channel because they're mammals, we're mammals, we're all animals. Let's just, hey, you and me, baby. Unfortunately, that kind of thinking, that kind of counselling is used in the courts of law to explain why a man will commit incest or rape, which really is saying this man is no better than my dog. Is that the kind of people we are? Dogs? Do you really believe that we are animals? The scriptures say we are not animals. Now, does this mean we ought to get down on animals, that animals are no good? No. I like dogs. I like animals. I like dogs. Cats, kind of put up with it if they're in your house. I love cows because they're made of steak. But we are the image of God. We are the image of God. Genesis 1 also challenges the thinking in our world that says the world revolves around self. And so the world revolves around self so much in our world that we no longer call distinction between male and female. We are just persons. And if we're just persons, then I can do whatever I like to whoever I like, whenever I like. And you can't stop me, so let me change the legislation of the country so I can have my way, fulfill my desires, satiate my drives. The Bible says we are male and we are female, and together we are the image of God. as we relate to each other across gender in community, as we spend time with one another. We are the image of God. That means women are not the lesser being. It means men are not the superior being. We together are the image of God. And friends, this is the breathtaking wonder of our origin. Deliberately, carefully created by God Himself to be His image. And Genesis is not done. Verse 26 tells us we're created in the image of God to rule over creation. Or another way to say it is we are to be the cultural engineers of the world in which we move, to shape it. We are not slaves to satiate the appetites of the gods, as a number of those ancient creation myths say. We are the image of God created to shape the world in which we live. And Genesis 3:9 indicates do that in community with God Himself. And as breathtaking as all of that is, as honourable as it is to be the zenith of God's creation, the goal is even better. Right at the very end of the reading that Andre read out, we're told the seventh day God finished His work and all His labour and declared rest. Now this isn't, you know, grab a cool drink after a long day mowing lawns and or a little one with an umbrella in it. It's not. Rest here means everything is in perfect harmony. God with His image. Image with image. Image with all of creation. And image in harmony with self. It's all shalom. It's all peace. It's all rest. There is no evil or pain or suffering in this part. There is no injustice or exploitation or slavery. There is no child abuse or any abuse. These things are non-existent. There's not even a hint of illness or death or mourning. And there was no shame. At the end of chapter 2 in Genesis, we're told the man and his wife were both naked and they felt no shame. Here is our origin. Here is our purpose. We are the image of God and we are here to shape our world. Of course, you look around and you go, well, is it just a myth? Like what happened? Well, like an elite athlete, Adam, like an elite athlete, Adam's potential was destroyed by his own hand. Think Lance Armstrong. Think NRL rugby league players, drug and alcohol. Adam's potential was destroyed by his own hand. That story's in Genesis chapter 3, where the image of God turned its back on the God in whose image it was created and walked away and said, we don't want anything to do with you. At that moment, everything was damaged. Relationships between the image were shattered. They were no longer naked before each other. No longer did they not feel shame. They had to clothe themselves because they were ashamed. The relationship with the Creator was ruined. The image hid from God, as if He can hide from God. And the relationship with creation was shredded. And we were kicked out of the Garden of Eden. And so we now live life outside of the garden, which is graphically revealed to us as we read on in Genesis, where in Genesis chapter 4, brother murders brother. In Genesis chapter 5, death is like a nuclear shockwave which overtakes all of the human race. And as we read on, we get to the New Testament and we find that Jesus is disturbed by this. He stands at the open tomb of Lazarus. And we are told in John 11 verse 33 that He is deeply moved. He is troubled in spirit. This is not, at this instance, He is not caught up with the grief of the death of a loved one. That is explained in another verse in John 11. At this moment, he's deeply troubled in spirit. And the language is used of war horses about to go into battle. And if you look at their noses, their nostrils flare with excitement, with intensity, with a sense of battle. Jesus stands at the open tomb of Lazarus. His nostrils are flaring in anger because this should not happen. Death should never happen. And yet, it's our reality. And so here's a question. What are we going to do with this? We have a memory of and a hope for a better world. Do we just medicate our souls with busyness and drugs and alcohol? Do we give in to eat, drink and be merry because tomorrow we die? Is that what we do? Well, they would be reasonable things to do if God had not rolled his sleeves up. We will hear more of what God has done as we continue his story, our story. But it's enough to say today that Adam's potential, though it was destroyed, there is a second Adam. We read of him in Romans 5. We're told that through the first Adam, death came into the world and death came to every human being. But in the second Adam, life came. We know him by the more popular name, Jesus. Adam's potential, first Adam's potential unraveled. The second Adam's potential is unfolding. This means that any and all who would follow Jesus, this image of God shattered by the first Adam, will find that they are being recreated in Christ. And we now have a hope for the future. And not only is that so, but our purpose has been restored. Jesus told us that we are to be salt to the world. Salt was used to arrest decay. John Stott, the great preacher from the 20th century, said, if the meat is rotting, you can't blame the meat. It's the meat's job to rot. If the meat's rotting, you've got to blame the salt for not being in the meat. If society is rotting around us, we can't blame society because society lives outside the garden. It's the job of society to rot. And so we can't blame society. We need to blame the church for not being in society to arrest decay. We are called by Jesus to engage in our world, to arrest the decay that we see, not blaming society, but rather getting engaged in it to arrest its decay and change it. And so, my brothers and sisters, I want to say to you, please don't let the loud voices that say to you, the church has no role, don't listen to them. Don't listen to the atheists and their loud voices who will scare and try to scare us into submission and inaction. I kind of want to say at this point in time, just remember empty vessels make the most noise. They have nothing to say. Don't let them scare you. We are the image of God, being recreated by the second Adam to look just like him. And he has given us a purpose. Engage in the engineering of our culture. Bear in mind this too. A culture is not thoroughly transformed until more people are reconnected with Jesus. Because as they get connected and as they follow, lives change, families change, suburbs change, schools change, workplaces change, a city changes, enough cities change, a nation changes, enough nations change, an area changes, the world changes as people are introduced to Jesus. Now, friends, there are many great stories that captivate us, Man of Steel, Harry Potter, all of those stories, and they cause a heart to skip a beat, almost to the point of shedding tears at some moments. And because they stir a longing of transformed life, a life of purpose, and the re-enchantment of the world. That is why they stir us. But while they feed our longings, the stories are somewhat cruel, aren't they? Because they excite the longing but never deliver a reality. At first glance, the Bible's story of creation looks much the same, except for one difference. The second Adam has come, and he has walked the earth. Jesus' life, his death, his resurrection are historical realities. And as we will see, the second Adam is the linchpin. And so this account of creation is true. And you can let your heart skip a beat, your longing explore it. Because in so doing, you will discover who you are and why you are here.